My name is John Watkins, and I teach at Ferris State College in Big Rapids, Michigan. My teaching area is speech communication, and a good share of that time is spent in teaching the area of listening skills. Just being a college professor makes me want to start off this whole thing with a question, and I'd like to have you write it down. If you don't have anything to write with, maybe somebody can wave their hand frantically in the air with an extra pencil or something. If somebody, can we get those who have extra pencils together with those who? Are we supposed to use these to write on the back? Yeah, you write on the back of those, please. The question I have for you, many of you are aware by now that the topic deals with listening, and so I'd like you to write down there what you expect to get out of this session by the end of this hour. I'd like to know what your expectations were when you came in here. By the end of this hour, what you expect to have had happen. Just jot that down in your own words on that sheet of paper. Now, if you haven't finished writing now, you at least know pretty well what you were going to write. And so let me ask you, how many of you were going to write down something there that said that you expected to be a better listener at the end of this hour than you were when you came in? How many of you wrote something that would mean something like that? Okay, now I find that to be a very common response that people put down. And you, in fact, usually whenever I go out to talk about listening, people, 90% of them, will say, I expect to be a better listener when you're finished than you were when you started. And I want to tell you now what is not going to happen in this session. You will not be a better listener at the end of this hour than you were when you came in.
What?
That's true. Absolutely true. You'll still be saying what at the end of this session. Okay? So,
but you're saying it to yourself.
That's true. Now, what I'd like to do, though, is take a few minutes to explain to you why you're not going to be a better listener. I'd like to have you do some things with me. First thing I'd like you to have you do is to clasp your hands in front of you like this.
No more writing.
Now, no more writing, not for the time being. Okay. Just clasp the hands in front of you like this. Now glance down and take a look at which thumb you put on top. Now that you've got that figured out, I'd like you to really shake out those hands so they're really nice and limber. And I'd like you to have you now reclasp those hands with the other thumb on top. Okay, now, I'd like to have you now fold your arms across your chest and glance down and notice which arm you have on top. Now, I'd like to have you really get limbered up and limber up those shoulders really well. You know, it's been one of those days. Now, I'd like to have you refold your arms with your other arm on top.
Not easy.
There's still some going on. Okay. Now, why was that awkward?
Habit.
All right, for it to happen. Now, if I tell you right now, in fact, I will tell you right now, please reclasp your hands. Didn't you just reclasp them the way you had done it the first time? You did not. How many did not? There were three who did not. Okay. The majority of us go back to that original pattern that we had. How many of you have been to Europe? How many of you have? All right, now, if you were in a non-English speaking country in Europe, and you wanted to find an American, because you were desperate to talk with an American, where would you go to find an American and recognize them immediately, even though they didn't say a word?
Restaurant.
Restaurant, why? Okay, the way Americans handle their fork and knives. Now, Americans, at least I found this more limited to right-handed Americans, interestingly enough, but Americans often will use what I refer to as the cut and switch method of eating. So if we have a big steak in front of us, we plunge in the fork, we take the knife, we whack off that piece of meat, then we lay our knife down, we switch our fork over, and shovel it in.
That's the way my wife told me to do it.
She was right for America, yeah. But if she were European, she would not tell you to do that. Because the European typically will plunge in the fork, cut off the piece of meat, and bring the meat to the mouth with the same hand that the fork was in originally. So, now I want you to imagine, take an imaginary situation here, that I come to your home as a member of the CIA, and I say, you are an absolute perfect lookalike for somebody in Europe, and we need to have you go and replace them there for us, but we can change your, or help you change your language skills so that you can speak the language flawlessly, but in the meantime, you're going to have to make sure that you change your habit pattern from the cut and switch method to the European method of eating. Because if once you goof up and slip and cut and switch, you're dead. Now, at that instant, how confident do you feel about your ability to change your habits? It's a little bit shaky for some people. Okay. Now, let me go into one last questionnaire. How many of you either are now or have been smokers? How many are now or have been smokers? Okay, there are about 7 or 8 of us, 9 of us, something like that in the group. Those of you who have never smoked in your lives, have you ever wondered why those of us who have, and I include myself in that number, have you ever wondered why we just don't take the darn things, throw them in the garbage, and walk away? How many have wondered about that? Okay, we have at least an equal number who have wondered about that. All right, for those of us who have been or are now smokers, I'm going to come to our defense. Because several years ago, I went through a smoking cessation program. I spent $140 in order to quit smoking. I figured I'd get my money back eventually. And so, at the time that I quit smoking in that program, I had been smoking at a rate of 30 cigarettes a day. That's a pack and a half. Pack and a half a day. Now, with that pack and a half of cigarettes, those 30 cigarettes, I had been taking about, on the average, 10 drags per cigarette per day. I mean, per cigarette. Now, how many times in the course of a day was I doing this? 300 times. How many times in the course of a week was I doing this? 2,100. How many times in the course of a month? Check your math, where's your calculator?
And tell us to bring one.
All right. How many times was I doing this?
8,500.
About, all right, let's take 8,500, all right? How many times in the course of a year was I doing that? 10,000. Over a period of 10 years, how many times had I done that?
12,000.
Wait, I gave you the wrong figure before. All right. Now, over the course of a year, I would have been doing this 100,000 times. In the course of 10 years, I would have done it how many times? About 1,000,000 times. And at the time that I quit smoking, I had smoked for 25 years. How many times have I been doing that? 2.5 million times. Now, what I want you to appreciate is that I've got a reasonably good mind. But I've got a very stupid hand. And this stupid hand of mine could not distinguish between a cigarette and pretzels, and candy, and peanuts,
ice cream,
and popcorn, and ice cream, and anything else that I could bring to the mouth. And within a very short time after that, period of months, I gained 25 pounds. And when 8 months later, my wife and I were sitting in a restaurant, and she lit up a cigarette, and I was kind of curious what a cigarette would taste like after 8 months. This old hand went right back into performance, or stayed in performance, and I resumed becoming a smoker again. Now, I have since quit again, and I've now quit 14 months pray for me, will you? Okay, because I don't want that final temptation. Now, I'm sharing all this, and I really dwelled on a very simple point. And the simple point really has to do with habituation. And the reason I stress that so strongly is because in the course of a normal day, you and I listen, on the average, to 2,000 reasonably intact messages. 2,000 messages a day. How do we listen to those 2,000 messages? The same way that we did yesterday, and the day before, and the day before that. However we are habituated now as listeners, that's the way we're going to listen today, and that's the way we're going to listen the rest of this week. And that's why I'm not going to change anybody's listening skills here. So let me ask you then, if you would like to have me sort of help you test out where your listening skills are. Do you like that? Mm-hmm. Well, whether you like it or not, I've got it. I have with me a speech that takes roughly about 2 to 3 minutes to present. It's a speech that, to my knowledge, was originally presented by Dr. A. Parker Nevin of Princeton University. I think this is probably one of the finest speeches that I've ever come across of its kind. And so I'd like to have you merely sit back and relax. Don't take any notes on it. But afterward, I'm going to ask you then to jot down some information about the speech on that paper that you have there. Here's the presentation. Again, Dr. A. Parker Nevin presented this. He's with Princeton University. Ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed a great and undeserved privilege to address such an audience as I see before me. Never in the previous history of human civilization have greater problems confronted and challenged the ingenuity of man's intellect than now. What do we see on the horizon? What forces are at work? Whither are we drifting? Under what mist of clouds does the future stand obscured? My friends, casting aside the raiment of all human speech, the crucial test for the solution of all of these intricate problems to which I've just alluded is the sheer and forceful application of those immutable laws which down the corridor of time have guided the hand of man groping, as it were, for some faint beacon light for his hopes and aspirations. Without these vital principles, we are but puppets, responding to whim and fancy, failing entirely to grasp the hidden meaning of it all. We must readdress ourselves to these questions which press for answer and solution. The issues cannot be avoided. There they stand. It is upon you and you, and even yet upon me, that the yoke of responsibility falls. What then is our duty? Shall we continue to drift? No. With all the emphasis of my being, I hurl back the message, no. Drifting must stop. We must press onward and upward toward the ultimate goal to which all must aspire. But I cannot conclude my remarks, dear friends, without touching briefly upon a subject which I know is steeped in your very consciousness. I refer to that spirit which gleams from the eyes of a newborn babe, that animates the toiling masses, that sways all the hosts of humanity, past and present. Without this energizing principle, all commerce, trade, and industry are hushed and will perish from this earth as surely as the crimson sunset follows the golden sunshine. Mark you, I do not seek to unduly alarm or distress the mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters gathered before me in this vast assemblage. But I would indeed be recreant to a high resolve which I made as a youth if I did not at this time and in this place and with the full realization of the responsibility that I assume, publicly declare and affirm my dedication and my consecration to the eternal principles and receipts of simple, ordinary, commonplace justice. Now, without talking with anyone, I would like you to jot down the main idea of that presentation. The main point that Dr. A. Parker Nevin wanted to get across to his audience. If you haven't finished writing at this point, you know pretty much what you were going to write. And rather than ask you to individually share what you have written down there, let me sort of go with you through the speech very briefly. At the beginning of the presentation, what did Dr. A. Parker Nevin say? He said that the world was filled with problems. But if you'll think back, he never identified for us what those problems were. He then told us that there were solutions to those problems, but again, he never told us what the solutions were. And he said the responsibility was upon you and you, and even yet upon me, to do something with those solutions. They never told us how we were supposed to do that. So, in point of fact, in that 2 to 3 minute presentation, Dr. A. Parker Nevin said what?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. There was no speech, or no message in that speech at all.
Except the last word, justice.
If that has meaning for you, yes.
I was thinking this is a legitimate speech, otherwise, that's what I was thinking, but then I just said we must work very hard to create a just world. That's about all I could come up with.
Okay, well let me go through some background on this speech. Now I told you that this was probably one of the finest speeches of its kind that I'd ever come across. And of the speeches that say nothing, this is probably the best I've ever heard. And I suppose you could say that I have sort of guided you down the garden path with that. But yet, recognize how much we believe that simply because somebody is opening their mouths, or simply because they have been introduced, we make some sort of assumption that they have something to say. I bet you even came over here today with the idea you were going to learn something here. See, you had an expectation there. Now, actually, this speech was given by Dr. A. Parker Nevin at Princeton, and he gave it to all of the incoming freshmen at Princeton University. And his purpose in doing so was to find out how well those incoming freshmen could listen. And he did it a little bit differently than I did. He did go through the presentation, but instead of saying, hey, write down the main idea, he said, you now have 20 minutes to write a summary of the speech. And so those incoming freshmen, you know, what do they do? You know, they get an order and they act, you know, and they took that paper and they wrote. And Dr. Nevin collected all those papers. He then went through them and sorted them out for areas of commonality. What did they have in common? And he found that they fell very naturally into four stacks of papers. The first stack of papers represented 15%. If we responded the same way, perhaps three or four of us here. These were the people who doubted the compositional worth of the speech. Now, I want you to understand this. They didn't doubt that there was a message in there. They just thought it was put together rather poorly. That was their objection to it. There was a second group. This group, also 15%, these were the people who doubted their own listening abilities. And if we, any of us responded the same way, we were saying to ourselves, you know, I've always been a rotten listener. And boy, does that speech prove it. In other words, we didn't question the speaker at all. It was our fault that we didn't get anything out of that message. The third stack of papers represented 49%, almost half of those incoming freshmen. These were the students, gosh, this would have made somebody pleased, I don't know who. These were the students who got a definite message from the speech. In other words, they wrote a treatise on what that speech said. Now, among these students, that message differed from one paper to the next, 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 to the next. Did the students believe the message that was in there? Of course they did, because they were the ones that put it in there. Why wouldn't they believe it? There was one last group, one last stack, and these were 21%, 1 in 5, who said, that speech has no message in it. And they quit writing at that point, 1 in 5. Now I want to put this into context for you, because I have spent many years of my life teaching in community colleges as well as four-year schools. And I've really liked my experience in teaching in community colleges, because we have typically what is known as the open door policy. Now, if you had a son or a daughter, or if you wanted to go to a community college, what kind of a prerequisite, what kind of a background would you have in order to go to a community college? All right, many people will say the high school diploma. It isn't necessary. All right, what else then? If that doesn't do it, what else would do it? Pardon?
The GED.
All right, would that be the same as the GED kind of thing, the high school equivalency? Well, it's nice to have it, but for a community college, you often don't have to have that.
Residence.
Pardon?
Residence?
No, not required.
Is there money to pay the tuition?
We do have grants. I think you're getting the message here. If you want to go to a community college in most states, all you have to do is be able to breathe with a reasonable amount of regularity. If you can do that, you can get into the local community college. And I think that's really special, because for the many years that I taught in community college, it was really neat. I had what I referred to as the homogenized milk of academia. I had some of the very, very bright, and I had some of the very, very not so bright. And it was just a really neat kind of cross-section of humanity there. And I liked that, and it was neat. Now, if you wanted to go to most state universities, what qualification must you meet? All right, grade points are often involved.
ACT scores.
All right, the entrance exams are often involved. And most states have a provision that as long as you are in the upper third, or maybe in some state, your state it might be the upper half, but as long as you're in the upper percentage of your high school graduating class, you can get into the state university. They have to service your needs. Okay? That's typically true. In other words, the state universities are saying, community colleges, you can have the homogenized milk, but we want the cream of the high school graduates. If you want to go to Princeton University, what percentage of your high school graduating class should you be in?
2%.
I heard it over here. Usually about the top three. I think they may have slipped once in a while and gone to the top five. But about the top 3% of your high school graduating class. Now, I've given you this as a perspective because I want to emphasize for you, please notice that this study, ladies and gentlemen, was not done by the community college at that level. It was not done at the state level. It was done at Princeton, where they did not have the cream. They had the whipping cream of America's high school graduates. And to me, when 1 in 5 of those students is able to detect that there was no message in that speech, that's pretty sour cream, isn't it? And how much worse is it going to be as we go down to those earlier levels, those lower levels, I suppose, or if you'll think of the millions of people who never walk through a college doorway in their lives. Now I look at that, and to me I say that is a national tragedy when we are that poor listeners on such a scope. Now, I want to move from that national level because I believe in getting personal. And I'm going to give some personal examples, not on my own, but just some rather human examples that I've come across over the last several years. Some of you can perhaps identify with them. I'm thinking particularly during the time that we lived in Phoenix. There was one night when a motorcycle patrolman around town was going along one of the main streets, Grand Avenue, and noticed in behind the Westerner Motel there was a camper parked. So he radioed in that he was going to investigate. He apparently pulled up behind it, got off his cycle, started walking toward the camper. The rear door of the camper opened, a shotgun was stuck out, and he was literally, in a way, blown away. He made it back to his motorcycle, dragged himself back to his motorcycle, the camper had left, and he radioed in his location. And I have been told by people on the Phoenix Police Department, or in the Phoenix Police Department, that if we were to listen to that tape, we would be virtually appalled at the listening that was going on, because Phoenix officers were riding on all sides of this fellow, trying to find him. And they simply were so confused, and they weren't listening, and the man eventually died beside his cycle. Now, I don't know, maybe he would have died anyway, but nevertheless, it was terribly tragic. And I know of what they're saying about that tape that was made of the radio, in the radio room. I'm thinking also of, I guess it must be 10 years now, or maybe even a little bit more, when I went back to eastern Montana to visit my folks, and I got up one morning and I picked up the Billings, Montana Gazette. And across the headlines was a very striking headline of a very tragic tale. The story told of a Regina, Saskatchewan hospital in which a nurse's aide was told to go and feed the newborns. She did. The headline told of 12 infants who died in that hospital because that nurse's aide had gone to the wrong shelf and fed saline solution instead. Now that, to me, obviously was terribly tragic, as I'm sure it was to other people who read it and those of you who've heard about it now. And I thought, what a terrible thing, it couldn't happen again. Within 3 months later, the identical circumstance, not saline solution, but another toxic substance was fed to infants in a Boston hospital, and more infants died. Now I want you to think about that. How about those nurses' aides? Were they told to go to page 33 of the hospital manual, procedures manual, and follow what was there? No, they weren't given a memo. They were told, and they simply didn't listen. And put yourself in the place of those nurses' aides. How do you approach those parents and say, you know, I've always been a rotten listener, or I'm sorry, I guess I made a mistake. Those kinds of things don't cut it under those circumstances, do they? I need to let you know now, are there any nurses here? Okay, several of you, all right. Now, am I not correct that the American Hospital Association, within the last number of years, has established a regulation that will not allow toxic substances and food substances to be placed in the same location?
Right.
Okay, and this came as a result of these two cases, so you've probably heard about those before. Okay, let me give you one last example. Ralph Nichols, who is sort of regarded as a father of listening and teaching, at least in recent years, tells the story of a man in New York who was hired on with a new crew of a smeltering plant. And at the smeltering plant, they had a safety meeting right before these men went on duty. And during that safety meeting, these new employees were told, as you go out on shift, go to your forge, and hanging on the left-hand side of your forge will be the tools that you're to be using on your shift. They're cold, they're safe, they're for you to use. Use them on your shift, and as you go off shift then, take those now red hot, white hot tools and hang them on the right hand side. So, they went on the shift. After that shift was over, the regular next shift came on. One of the regular employees of many years' duration went out there to his forge, reached up, grabbed an implement. It was red hot, white hot, seared itself to his arm, fell to the floor. He eventually lost inability to listen. And I just turned the tape.
Thank you.
Now, how do you spell relief? How do you spell rotten listener? F-I-R-E-D. Fire. But the sad thing about it is, most of us, if we have been fired for inability to listen, have never really learned that was the reason we were let go. I can think back to a period in my life working in Phoenix where I had several work-study students. Now, these students were not costing us in the department anything. They were free help. And I would get a call from the work-study office every once in a while. They'd say, John, is there anything that you could have somebody do? We've got a student who needs someplace to be assigned so she can get her money. I'd say, sure, send her over. I'll find something for her to do. As it turned out, of all the students I've had working for me, the only two that I've ever fired were both work-study students who were not costing us anything directly. But with both of these gals, I realized that, gosh, I'd tell them to do something, I'd come in the next morning expecting it to be ready, and it'd be ready, but it would have been done incorrectly. Or it wasn't ready for me to take the class or whatever. And I didn't want them to lose their work study grant, so I'd say, well, I'll tell you what, I won't have you do that sort of thing anymore, so maybe if you could just answer the telephone for me. You know, just study and answer the telephone, yes.
I think I'm getting a little defensive here.
Okay.
There seems to be a distinction in different types of listening.
Oh, there is.
And it's like I started identifying with the guy that took the thing on the left instead of the right because I'm always getting mixed up between left and right. And what you're talking about here is kind of ability to quickly process verbal directions. Is it not?
I think that's true, taking it through to a conclusion, yes.
And
an actual conclusion.
So is that something that it's possible to get better at just as well as just sitting down and hearing somebody tell their life story? I mean, that can you get better at that?
Can you become a better listener?
In that specific type of listening.
Yes. Yeah, and in fact,
you're not
going
to tell us how.
Pardon?
You're not going to tell us how.
Well, maybe what I could share with you just as a quick aside here, that I do know from listening theory here, or listening research really, that you will have, in 10 minutes after you have heard me say something, you will have forgotten half of it. And I know that within 2 days you will have forgotten 75% of it. And I know that within a month, you'll have forgotten 98% of it. And so I guess, no, I'm not going to even go with that effort right now, because it just doesn't fit.
No, I'm not asking you to. I was just asking you.
But it can be taught. I need to stress that for you, that it can be taught. Okay. So I'm trying to think back to where I was.
You fired.
Yeah. Oh, all right, yeah. I was going, after I had these two gals doing these things, I told them to answer the telephone. And stupid me, what skill do you have to answer a telephone? And I was getting all sorts of messages that were incorrect. And so I finally had to call the work-study office and say, hey, I really don't have need for these girls anymore. Maybe you could reassign them. And pity the person to whom they got reassigned. See? But when I let those girls know that, did I say, hey, you're a rotten listener, I can't use you anymore over here? I didn't say that, did I? Because the immediate defense when we say, no, gee, you're not listening, is to say, oh, I will from now on. I've got a lot of things on my mind, and I, you know. But people who know anything about listening know that we cannot change habits that fast and have people become effective listeners who are not. And so I did what I'm sure a lot of other employers do, and I trumped up my own story. I said, you know, well, I imagine out there in the world now, people are saying, well, you know, the economy's been really bad, and we're trying to fend off a layoff, but it looks like we're going to have to have a layoff after all. And so this time we're going to lay off one, and it's you. Now, I think that's what happens. We cover over this listening excuse. All right, so, but let me move into one last area, because to me, you're about to get the most striking piece of information that you will get this whole period of time, maybe even the week, I don't know. And it's going to be striking because you're going to provide it for yourself. Some years ago, I inadvertently asked a question. I was talking about listening, and I inadvertently asked a question in one of my classes. And I'm about to ask that same question again. I don't want here a show of hands. Most other places where I have talked about it, I've asked for a show of hands. I don't want one here. But I do want you to think about how you would answer my question. Would you raise your hand? Or would you not? So I'm going to ask you that question now. This is the one I asked my class inadvertently. How many of you have one person who will listen to you when you have a problem? Now think very carefully. How many of you have one person who will listen to you when you have a problem? I don't want to show hands. But I want to share with you the answer I got that one day I asked that question. Because I've asked that question time and time again. Anytime I've talked about listening, that question gets asked, either asking for a show of hands or doing as I just did now, saying, I don't want one, but think about it. The first time I asked that question, I was blown away because fewer than 50% of my students were able to raise their hands. Fewer than 50%. And I want you to appreciate how tragic that is. Because, again, I was teaching at Phoenix College, Metropolitan Community College, and what that meant was that the average age of our student body was 26. And what that meant was that the typical student in my classes was married. Married to someone that they had fairly recently promised to love, to cherish, to adore. And all those promises that we made. But apparently there was something in that commitment that did not include the ears. And I think that is really tragic. Yes?
Do you really think that means that they had someone who would listen, or does it mean they didn't feel they had someone they could trust enough to really talk to if that was
what they were saying? True. Good point. You see, now, I think that is often the case, that we don't really trust the other person to listen to us. On the other hand, the thing that, and I talked about this last week, but let me just bring it up. Loving listening is a reciprocal process. And if you want a listener, then you have to be a listener. And many times that other person, you know, hasn't used it. We haven't been a listener, and we don't trust them to listen to us either. And I think that very frequently does happen. It's a good point. Something else I'd like you to understand about those students in that first class because 13% of them were the typical from high school into college living at home student, 13%. And if I were to go to the parents of those children and say, hey, what do you want for your kid? I know that those parents would say, I want the best for my kid. Now, the best may include the best clothes, it may include the best car, it may include the best of everything, but it doesn't include the best of my time, which is my time when I'll do nothing but listen to you. I think that's triumphant. And because that was a community college, no dormitories, people living in their hometown, the majority of my students had been living in the Valley of the Sun for 5, 10, 15 years, and in all that time had not made one true friend. And I think that's tragic. Now, I'm teaching in the Midwest now, Ferris State College, Big Rapids, Michigan. And I have found it's a little better out there, maybe, because it's a small town. It's a college of about 9,000. It is better, but it still is not helpful. Because typically, at least a third of my students do not have someone who will listen to them. Now, where do you go when you can't find a listener? You go to the Yellow Pages and look under L and go, oh, look at all those listeners. You don't find them under L, do you? You do find them in the Yellow Pages, but they're listed under P for psychiatrist, P for psychologist, S for social worker, C for counselor. These are the professional listeners. And I have a number of friends in that community, in the mental health community. And I know if you were to go to any of my friends there and say, hey, what can you do for me? Any one of them would say, I'm not going to do anything for you. You'll have to do it yourself, but I'll listen to you along the way. I know that would be their response. They would be virtually professional listeners. Now, several years ago, I was doing some consulting work, and this was during the time I was at Phoenix College, and I went to Texas, to a small town in Texas called Andrews. How many of you know of Andrews? That figures. Anyway, I went to Andrews to talk about listening to the elementary school teachers there. And during that time, I shared a story. And they could relate to it very well, because it told of a young man who went to a psychiatrist's office and he said, I need to talk with the doctor. And the receptionist said, you have an appointment. And he said, no, but I need to talk to the doctor. Well, I'm sorry, you can't see the doctor, but I'm afraid I'm going to kill someone. I'm sorry. You have to have it. The next day, that young man, Charles Whitworth, went to the top of the University of Texas Tower and shot 16 people. He could not even pay for a listener. And when I shared that in Texas, you know, they could really relate to that. And then I went back to Phoenix and finished out the spring term. And as I was finishing out teaching that spring term, I was driving along Indian School Road, one of the main thoroughfares there in Phoenix. And that was my regular drive. And every day I'd drive down to the college and back that way. And I watched one young fellow. I judged him to be maybe 22, 23. And I was kind of interested in him because he was wearing shorts like mine. And he was wearing, you know, a light shirt. And he was walking very laboredly with a cane. And so I just sort of judged that this fellow probably had been in an accident or something. And every day, every morning, I would see him out there walking somewhere along Indian School. And every evening, he'd be out there walking. And it was so neat through that spring term to watch him as he would just gradually get to be taking better strides. And then summer session came along, and I taught summer session, and I watched that fellow day after day after day. And I finally reached the point where I went to the faculty lounge one day, and I had just seen this guy. And I said to one of the other faculty members, you know, I've been having the neatest experience, because every day there's this guy out there walking with his cane, and he's really getting better. I don't know why. He said, well, don't you know who he is? I said, no. He said, his name's Jessic. He's Dr. Jessic's son. And he was working out to become an Olympic boxer. And he was going out for the Olympic team, and he got into an auto accident. And they told him that he would never walk again. And so, you know, it was just so very neat for me that fall when I was standing at our registration tables, and or away from them a ways, and I saw Jessic walk over to the speech communication tables. And I saw him sign up for some classes there, and I went right over there, over to the tables, right afterward, and I said to my colleague there, I said, Lou, did he sign up for any of my classes? And he said, no, he signed up mostly for regular TV. I said, oh, okay. The next time I heard about Jessic was 5 minutes later. He was lying dead on our gymnasium floor. He had been shot by another student. And he was shot by a man who, for the previous 3 weeks, had been doing everything he could to get in to see a doctor, from one psychiatrist to another, and he could not get in. Now, I shared last week some figures that would explain why he couldn't get in, because right now we have 45,000 psychiatrists in the United States. Half of these are located in 5 states, in California, New York, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and Illinois, and also the District of Columbia, 5 states, half of them are there. 2/3 of our counties in the United States have no one in mental health for us to go to. So it wasn't really strange that these two doctors, the one that Whitworth went to and the ones, or the other doctors that, the fellow's name was Charles Doss, went to. He couldn't, you know, get in because they're deluged. Now there was another figure too that I shared last week, and there are a few of you who were with me in that session at that time. And so I'd like to ask you, where do we, well, let me say that in 1980 the Gallup report came out to tell where Americans go when they have a problem. And those of you who were here last time, or last week, you remember where we as Americans go? Where do we go first? We go to another family member. That's our first resource. When we're hurting, we go to another family member. Where else do we? Where's the second place we go?
Friend.
All right, we go to a friend. Second place. Third.
Minister.
No.
Doctor.
No. The Bible. The Bible is the third place we go. The fourth place, then, is the minister. The fifth place is our family doctor. The sixth place is to books other than the Bible. The seventh place we go is to a professional counselor. Now, we don't want to go to a counselor anyway then, do we? And so our first line of defense in terms of our emotional, our mental health, is another family member, isn't it? That's where we're going to go when we're hurting. Now, why should we learn to listen? I can think of 2 very good reasons to become expert listeners. One is because your own family is going to come to you to listen to them. And I think that's a whale of a reason. And a second one is that your friends are going to come to you to listen to them. And I think that also is a whale of a reason. Now, as I said, I can't talk to you, or I can't train you in listening skills for listening for information. But over the next several days, I can share some ideas that did not certainly originate with me. In fact, I'm going to use a model that's been fairly common. How many of you have heard of Tom Gordon and parent effectiveness training? How many of you have had that kind of training? Okay. For those of you who have, let me just tell you ahead of time, I'm going to go over some Tom Gordon's material in the next couple days. And that, I think, will provide us a basis for being able to listen to those people that we care the most about. Recognizing what the time is up there and so forth, let me just sort of wind up by saying, bringing your attention to one of the neatest experiences I have had in my life, where just a matter of a few years ago, I was saying to myself, you know, I'm about through with my degree, and I'm wondering what the Lord would have me do with my life at this point. And I found that there was a Lutheran Cogatus coming up just the next weekend as I was thinking about this. And a Cogatus, for those of you who are not acquainted with it, is similar to a Curcio. And if you're not acquainted with a Curcio, let me say it's a men's retreat or a women's retreat, whatever. But anyway, this retreat was coming up, and I thought, maybe what I'll do is make the retreat and figure out what the Lord would have me do with my life. And so I went on the retreat, and we had a very nice dinner. Everybody got introduced, and then we had our first session, and I walked into that first session. And the retreat master introduced the topic, and he said, our topic this evening is that listening is a ministry. I thought, wow, I've had a ministry for 20 years and I didn't even know. And the neat thing about that is that that is a ministry that every one of us can share with the people that we care about. And I have several plaques on my office wall. I get them confused every once in a while, so I just want to read them. I think it might be useful for you to think about here. The first one is that God gave us a mouth that closes and ears that don't, which should tell us something. The second plaque I have is we have two ears and one mouth that we may listen the more and talk the less. And the one that I really love is one that bears a certain resemblance to another statement, and it is the one that says, listen to others as you wish they would listen to you. So, let me stop at that point and see if there are any observations or any comments, any questions. Yes?
Have we become a society that listens less because, you know, that's what you hear parents in particular saying all the time, that kids don't listen to me anymore because of TV. There's all the media coming at us all the time. And are we using that as an excuse, or is that really a reason that we don't hear what's being said to us a lot?
I think that's a useful observation more than a question.
In your studies, have you found that that's really true, that the kids aren't listening and that we can blame things, or is that just a statement we make as an excuse?
All right. Now, I don't know how we would ever compare that in terms of the past. I think Socrates at one point had similar kinds of observations. I mean, I'm sure that's true all the way along. But what I can share with you is this, that children, when they are growing up, when they reach the first grade, I don't know if you've noticed, but they really are really pretty superb listeners. And they are superb to the extent that if they say, Daddy said this, you can be pretty sure that Daddy said it. Because from what the literature is showing, 95% efficiency on immediate recall. Now, if you have children who are in the first grade and you're worried about them quoting you to someone, don't worry too much, because in the next level, second grade, that will drop to 85% efficiency. By the time they reach the end of the eighth grade, they're ready to start high school, that their listening efficiency level will be down to the level of yours and mine. Now, isn't that tragic? Remember what I said a few minutes ago, 50% after 10 minutes, you said. And one of the things that that is fascinating about that is that listening level, we don't teach it for the most part in the schools. It typically is not taught. I mean, they may have a few exercises and so forth, but there's really no concerted effort as there is with reading. And so here is our listening and reading, if we were to take that at par, and then the listening, our reading skill gets a tremendous amount of training, and the listening skill sort of comes along too, and it stays ahead of reading until the end of the eighth grade, when reading skill surpasses listening at that point. Now, in other words, the listening area has been sort of left to function by itself out here without any training. And so the reading gets that. Now, I could say that when you recognize that, well, people frequently will say, well, we can listen because we can hear. But nobody ever said we could read because we could see. And they both involve symbol systems, and they both need to be learned. There's another hand up over here.
I was
going to
say, I see two different kinds of listening that we're talking about here, like with the Whitworth boy and the other boy, the Osh boy. There's the kind of listening where we are taking in information, and then there's the kind of listening where we really listen to the heart message and
exactly.
are able to share and give back. And I don't have too much trouble with that part of it. I think this is what this lady was getting at too, you know, that the differences, you know, in that I can just really share of myself well, and I think other people can share with me. My problem is keeping my mouth shut, not sharing so much of myself, you know. But as far as listening and taking in information, being able to digest it and to really remember it for recall later, and so that's where I have my problem. So what are we going to talk about
in the next several days?
With those two different kinds of listening.
All right. All right, the distinction is between cognitive listening and affective listening, okay? And I'm glad you brought that out, because that's a distinction that I was making without acknowledging it, and I'm glad you acknowledged it for me, because I should have done that. I am going to be giving my emphasis now on empathic or affective listening, listening to other people when they're having some strong feeling, and not on listening for cognitive information. Now, to me, you can't really separate the two entirely, but you place more emphasis on one than the other, because the message has both cognitive, in fact, any communication has cognitive, affective, and behavioral components, and you can't really isolate them one from the other, but you can give attention to more to one than the other. Okay? Thank you for bringing that up. Anybody else, any observations, questions? Anybody who would like to stay behind? Please do so. I love to talk.
Thank you.
I also like to listen.